The sad truth is the USDA labeling system is intentionally fraudulent.
Changed everything. Check out this review on beef organs from Heart and Soil Supplements. I've been taking beef organs, Firestarter, and whole package for almost 3 months, and I can say that I haven't had this much benefit from a whole food supplement ever in the past. Inflammation decreased, I'm sleeping better, waking up with motivation, less organ discomfort, balanced libido. Life has become easier to navigate since introducing the beef organs along with an animal-based diet. Check this out. Even my plant-based wife has ditched her old eating habits and is all in animal-based now. Amazing product. This kind of stuff gets me so excited, guys. Beef organs is heart, liver, kidney, spleen, and pancreas. It's basically the ultimate multivitamin, except it's sourced from animal organs. And at Heart and Soil, we're only using regeneratively raised, grass-fed, grass-finished organs in a glass bottle, the finest on the planet. You can find us at heartandsoil.co. Our mission is to help you reclaim your birthright to radical optimal health. I mean, maybe your wife or girlfriend were ditched her vegan eating habits and go animal-based with you too. That would be an added bonus. So check us out, heartandsoil.co. On this week's podcast, I had the pleasure, the honor of talking to my friend Will Harris, who is the chief cowboy at White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia. You may have heard of him or seen him on Rogan's podcast. I've known Will for many years and spent a lot of time at White Oak in person. And so we start the podcast with a really cool illustration of how powerful regenerative agriculture is by looking at two different samples of soil taken by on Will's farm and the farm right next door. So if you're listening to this, we tried to describe it, but you might want to check out that part online on the video feed on YouTube. But we get into discussions around what regenerative agriculture is, how Will got into this process, where his thinking process changed, how it's different than mainstream agriculture, what Will thinks of factory farming, whether regenerative agriculture is scalable, what we're going to do with this long term. And we have the climate conversation a little bit, talking about the carbon cycle and whether cows are killing the planet or whether there's a potential that if you raise these cows properly, they could be one of our most valuable assets. And obviously, I believe it's the latter, but listen to this podcast with Will to find out. So enjoy this podcast with Will Harris from White Oak Pastures. Sponsors make this podcast possible. Want to give a shout out to them and appreciate their support. First, foremost, want to start with Kalima Sea Salt. These are my friends who make an amazing sea salt that is free of ocean-borne microplastics found at drpaulsalt.com. And you can get a free bag if you go there. But did you know that every year humans dump 8 million tons of plastic garbage in the ocean? And that's where your table salt comes from. Those little pieces of microplastic can form the core of salt. That's what's in the middle of those salt crystals. So when you sprinkle it on your steak, veggies, or whatever, you can be eating little pieces of plastic. And we don't really fully understand what these do in humans, but the preliminary data in animals looks really bad. A new study reveals that microplastics are found in 90% of all salt tested, but Kalima Sea Salt is free of ocean-borne microplastics. You'll get your first bag free by going to drpaulsalt.com. It's freaking delicious. It's a great finishing salt. It's one of my favorites out there, if not my favorite, definitely. And it's hand-harvested, and it's harvested from the Kalima salt flats in Mexico. So you're supporting local industry there, the Salineros in Mexico. It's 100% all natural, unrefined, handmade, and hand-harvested sea salt. Again, drpaulsalt.com for your free bag. Also want to tell you guys about my friends at Zero Acre. You can find them at zeroacre.com/Paul to get free shipping on your order of cultured oil. ZeroAcre.com. What is cultured oil? Well, if you listen to the podcast I did with Jeff Knobs and Tucker Goodrich about seed oils, you know that I'm not a fan of high linoleic acid oils like seed oils. The folks at Zero Acre, Jeff Knobs is leading the charge there, are pretty smart. And they came up with a way to create an oil, a cultured oil, that has essentially very, very small amounts of linoleic acid in it. Tallow, 2% linoleic acid. Butter, 2% linoleic acid. Ghee, 2% linoleic acid. Coconut oil, 2% linoleic acid. Seed oils, 45 to 50% linoleic acid. The tricky part with tallow, butter, and ghee is they're not liquid at room temperature. So what I like about the Zero Acre cultured oil is it's a liquid oil. So if you want to put it on your salad, I don't know why you do that, it's a liquid at room temperature, and it's very low linoleic acid. It's less than 2%, so it's just like animal fats, but it's liquid oil. So that makes it really cool. And there's nothing else in it other than oleic acid, which is the omega-9 monounsaturated fatty acid found in olive oil and some saturated fats in that oil too. So I hope that most restaurants will use Zero Acre to replace their cooking oils. And that would be a huge step in the right direction from a health perspective. It's great for frying, roasting, sauteing, stir frying, baking, dressing, drizzling, etc. And if you've seen my social media, you know that canola, these seed oils, they're a huge problem in terms of the way they're grown, in terms of resources. But Zero Acre doesn't take up any land, and the carbon footprint is so much better than these mainstream seed oils. So check them out at zeroacre.com, zeroacre.com/Paul for free shipping. And also read their blogs. They have some amazing white papers on how seed oils are connected with obesity and cardiovascular disease. They are a true resource. Zeroacre.com/Paul. Last but not least, shout out to my friends at Marek Health, M-A-R-E-K health.com. You can use the code Paul for 10% off your first lab order. So Marek is the premium telehealth platform connecting you with partner providers focusing on hormone optimization and preventive medicine. But this is what's cool. Like, it's hard enough to find a doctor who is going to focus on hormone optimization and preventive medicine, but to find a telehealth platform where you can do this from the comfort of your own home, this is amazing. And they let you order your own blood work. You guys have seen me order blood work for myself and talk about it on the podcast. In fact, a number of blood work panels I've gotten have been through Marek, and I designed a panel specifically with them. There is a Carnivore MD panel priced as low as $243 before the 10% off discount that you can find. It's the most bang for your buck labs that I think you should get. I usually get something a little more involved in this panel, but I wanted to make a panel that's very affordable for you guys. Testosterone, some basics in inflammation, all this kind of stuff. And that is the Carnivore MD panel at MarekHealth.com. So you have to know what is going on in your body to change it. And that's why a lab analysis is amazing. And then you can add on the potential for discussing the results of your labs with a provider and possible supplement recommendations, et cetera. You'll find that all at MarekHealth.com/CarnivoreMD. And you can use the code Paul at checkout for 10% off your first order. But go there, get your own labs, sign up with a provider. I really appreciate what they're doing and love this company. They are co-owned by Derek from More Plates, More Dates, who's a good friend of mine. I think they're doing good work in the world. So check them out, MarekHealth.com, M-A-R-E-K health.com. All right, guys, on to the podcast. Will Harris.
Hey, Paul, how are you?
My friend, you're a legend. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure to see you. I wish we were in person and doing this over a steak, but soon enough.
I wish we were doing it in person in Bluffton. I'm happy that you're in Costa Rica, and I'm happy I'm not in Costa Rica.
We'll talk about that after the podcast. I think you'd like Costa Rica. Will, I wanted to start the podcast with these two jars that you so kindly brought over, because when I was at White Oak, I've been there a number of times. This was one of the most striking things that you showed me. So we're going to get into all the stuff about regenerative agriculture today and how you did White Oak and the story, but I want to grab people. I want to hook them in the beginning, and I want people to see what's happening here. Now, if you guys are listening to this, you may want to go to the YouTube, and we'll do our best to describe what's happening here. But I want from the start for Will to show you guys these two jars and explain what's in them. And then we'll get the podcast off to a roaring start here.
All right. Good deal. So these are two glass jars containing soil that came from about 30 feet apart. This one on my farm and this one on a neighboring farm. And I'll show you here. This is a dead mineral medium that's about 0.5% organic matter. And this is a organic soil that is teeming with life. It looks like chocolate cake. And again, that's just a fence row between them. And what's significant is 25 years ago, this soil looked just like this soil. And the only difference is 25 years of holistic management using intensive animal impact, prescribed animal impact, which means doing it at the right time, versus this, which has been farmed very conventionally in a monocrop situation, corn followed by cotton followed by peanuts, with a lot of chemical fertilizer, a lot of pesticides, and a lot of tillage. And it's this is 5% organic matter. This is 0.5% organic matter. And to put that in context, this has got 5 times as much organic matter, 5% versus less than 1%. 1% organic matter in soil will absorb, like a sponge, a 1-inch rain event. A 1-inch rain event on an acre of land is 27,000 gallons of water. And it's not unusual in the coastal plain of Georgia, we're about 80 miles from the Gulf of Mexico, to get a 5-inch rain event. And when we get a 5-inch rain event, if it comes over 48 hours, we can absorb it here. All but 1/2 inch, 1/2 inch will be absorbed here, and the rest of it rushes down to the Gulf of Mexico. You know, we say that the water wants to go to Apalachicola Gulf in New Mexico, and that's where it's headed, unless we do the right things to hold it here so it can do the ecosystem benefit.
That's amazing. And I think, I mean, we were just talking before the podcast started about this video that you guys have on your White Oak Pastures Instagram. And I think what we'll do is we'll insert that video now so that everybody can see this. For those of you who are going to watch this video, this is a creek or a river right outside your farm. Well, what are we seeing in this video?
So in the video, it's actually a surface water ditch that goes through the farm. It doesn't run all the time. It runs when there's excess water. And this one was, spring was a year ago. But we got about a 6-inch rain event very quickly, which, as I said, is not super unusual. And water ran off of my farm, but it was a fraction of the water that ran off the neighboring farm that the silver soil sample came from. And the quality of the water, the water off my farm looked like weak tea, and the water coming off that farm looked like a strawberry milkshake. So it's both the quantity and the quality of the water. And again, it goes to the Apalachicola Bay in the Gulf of Mexico. That used to be one of the best oystering grounds on the East Coast, and they have an absolute moratorium against oystering there now because of what the water quality has done to the sea life.
So what you're describing, this is actually a really cool start to the podcast. So we've got these two different soils, and for those of you who are just listening, the first jar that Will had was from his neighbor's farm, which has had a bunch of monocrop agriculture, and it's kind of the color of, I don't know, it's like a light brown color. And in the other hand, Will has a jar that looks like coffee grounds. It's black. And that's the soil from Will's farm that's been farmed regenerative for 25 plus years now. And then Will was describing the different amounts of organic matter in these two soils. And then as you guys heard or saw on that video from the White Oak Pastures Instagram, when there's a catastrophic rain event, the more organic the matter in the soil, the more the soil can kind of sponge up the water and prevent the erosion. I mean, that is such a striking video, Will, of all of this topsoil running off of your neighbor's farm, which is like that light brown color, 1% organic matter, and then the White Oak Pastures dirt holding the water and not having all this topsoil running off and then not poisoning the Gulf of Mexico. So, I mean, this is really cool because I think this is a visual illustration for people of the power of ecosystems and what happens when you farm that land properly. So for anyone listening to this, let's just back up a moment, that doesn't understand what you do on your farm. Like, describe to us how White Oak Pastures is different than a monocrop agriculture farm or a farm raising cattle in a farm raising cattle in like a factory farmed way. How do you guys do this differently? What's going on there that's so different?
Well, I'll tell you that, but also let me tell you that it's you can see in that video the soil, the erosion that's happening. What you can't see is there's copious quantities of pesticides and chemical fertilizer in that land that's not coming off of our land. But we don't use pesticide and chemical fertilizer. So that's it's kind of the untold part of it that still exists. So we manage this farm holistically, and to us that means in restarting the cycles of nature. Industrial monocrop farming breaks the cycles of nature. It misuses technology to break the cycles of nature. It's interesting to me that no creature on Earth has ever been able to break the cycles of nature. But we humans, as puny as we are, have mastered technology to the point that we can literally break these cycles. And the cycles of nature, to me, are the water cycle, the energy cycle, the water cycle, the microbial cycle, the grazing cycle, carbon cycle, on and on, many cycles that are going on all the time in a natural environment. And those cycles of nature, when they're operating optimally, create an abundance. And the abundance is what we're supposed to be living off of. But the use of technology has allowed us to cheat the system so that we can get a greater abundance in the short run, but it comes with incredible unintended consequences. And those unintended consequences are unnoticed for a long time, and they're almost always undesirable. And in this case, they fall on the backs of the animals and the environment and the economy of rural America.
And so I remember driving around White Oak one time with you in a Jeep, and you were telling me the story of how it all got started. I mean, this is an interesting story that I'd love for you to share with people, because when your dad, White Oak, you told me that White Oak's been in your family for what, 6 generations, 125 years. Yeah. But when your dad farmed this land, he didn't do it the way you do it. So what happened, and how is it different now?
Yeah, that's to me, that's one of the parts of the farm story I enjoy most. So my great-grandfather came here in 1866 and ran the farm, followed by his son, my grandfather, who ran the farm. And those guys in the late 1800s, early 1900s, would have farmed in a way that was very focused on the benefit of the animals and the land and the local community. Not out of any altruistic nobility. It's just that the land was their wealth. And the animals were their income stream, and the local market was the only down market they could get to. So there was that system necessitated doing the right things by the land, the animals, and the community. My dad was born in 1920. He was the third generation to run the farm, and he took over the farm post World War II. And World War II was the game changer. That's when all the technology that had spun off the war effort was made available to farmers. Things like ammoniated fertilizer, pesticides. That was a game changer. And there was the need for cheap, abundant food. Europe was starving, and the industrialization of agriculture, moving to monocultures, made food obscenely cheap and wastefully abundant, and probably not as nutritious as it should have been. Paul, that gets over into what you have expertise in. And it impoverished the rural community. That commoditization and centralization rendered the economy of rural America to be economically irrelevant. Just wasn't needed anymore, and it became impoverished. So my dad farmed the farm that way and was very successful. He did very well with it for his lifetime. I took over the farm. I graduated from the University of Georgia College of Agriculture in 1976. And I farmed probably more industrially than my dad did. I torqued it up to another level and farmed that way for 20 years. And then I started to view things differently and started changing the way I farm. And then for the last 25 years, we've been moving into this, what I call kinder, gentler agriculture, food production. Two of my daughters, who are now the fifth generation, came back with their spouses. And between them, they've got five grandchildren who are the sixth generation on the farm. So that's the evolution.
And so what was it like when you took it over? Because I've heard you tell some pretty crazy stories about how the cattle were raised and what they were fed. And these, I think we could get more into this nitrate fertilizer and where that came from. And then what does it look like now? I think a lot of people have never been to a regenerative farm. They haven't seen white oak and they don't understand how you do things differently now.
So the focus of the industrialized monocultural factory farm is efficiency and taking cost out of production. And that's done most commonly by scaling up. And it's incredible the amount of efficiencies and cost containment you can do if that's your only focus. If nothing matters other than increasing efficiency, you can just really, really torque that up. But it comes at the expense of resilience. I think of resilience and efficiency as being yin and yang. And you've got to have some of both. It can't be all about one or the other. By the way, resilience to me is the ability of a system, in this case my farm, to handle adversity and continue to go on. And we endeavor to be as resilient as we possibly can. I operated that way for a long time. You ask about specifics. I guess one of those poignant specific is that somebody somewhere discovered, a land-grant university somewhere discovered, that you could feed chicken shit to cattle and they would gain weight on it. You know, it's incredibly cheap. This is chicken manure from big industrial operations, which would not just be pure chicken manure. It would have a lot of chemicals and things in it that are even more undesirable probably than the manure itself. But mixed properly with corn or something that's highly palatable and enough antibiotics to keep the animals from getting sick on it, you can very cost-effectively make animals gain weight in confinement by feeding it. It's a very unnatural foodstuff, and there's a lot wrong with it. But how to do it was, I guess still is, taught in land-grant universities. That's where I got it from. So things like that were pretty normal. Confinement feeding, monocultural operations, no symbiosis, no 1 + 1 = 3 that you get in nature, the abundance. So you can really produce a cheap crop if that's all you care about.
And so how does it look now? What do the cows on white oak pastures eat now? And how's it different?
Well, I'm probably a little not very objective, but I think it's beautiful. You know, it's a lot of different plants and animals and microbes living in symbiotic relationships with each other, kind of a Jurassic Park kind of a deal. You know, to me, it's like the Garden of Eden. But it looks a lot different from it than it did then. Of course, you saw the soil, how different it looks. Anyways, I had a monoculture of only cattle fed in confinement where they could not express instinctive behavior. They were just penned up there to eat. They're loose on the pastures. This farm is 3,200 acres, just about up into about 150, 30-ish acre paddocks. And we move the animals in the grazing season every single day, the cattle every single day. We also raise hogs, goats, sheep, rabbits, and 5 species of poultry. Again, animal movement is an essential part of the program and all of it. You know, animals are not meant to sit in one place. And we say that the hogs are meant to root and wallow, cows are meant to roam and graze, chickens are meant to scratch and peck, and not allowing them to express that instinctive behavior is a form of animal cruelty. So that's part of what we do.
So you're letting them move around. I mean, I've been on the farm and I've seen the movement. It's actually pretty cool. It's very humbling to be, I don't know how many cattle were there when we moved, maybe a thousand, a couple hundred at least.
I remember the last time you were here, we moved our biggest herd, which is about 1,000 mama cows. And most of them had calved by the time when you were here. So that was probably 700 or so calves. So 1,700 animals, 1 million, 2 million pounds of beef, and they go through a 16-foot gate in about 8 minutes, and they're not being pushed, they're being pulled. You know, they're moved every day, so they're like Pavlov's dog. When they see us coming, they start salivating, and they're standing there at the gate, and people ask how we push them through, and I say, you know, you need to get your ass out of the way. It's what you got to do.
And they ran through that gate and they went into this big field, I guess another 30-acre paddock with grass that was green and long. And so, and then after they spread out, I remember walking amongst them. We were taking photos and looking around, but these cows were happy and there were birds flying around and bugs. And it was this really interesting, idyllic scene where these cows had been on one pasture where there were some trees and they moved to another one and they were just happy as clams, you know, to mix my metaphors, you know, and they get to this new patch of land and they get this new fresh grass and they spread out and they just go about eating and they just look like happy, healthy animals. And like you described, there's other species interacting with them in that bigger space. And it's really pretty beautiful.
Well, and you just touched on how that improvement in the soil is made when you said they're moved. We confine them to really impact that grass. We want them to be turned on to big, sweet, pretty grass, and we want them to really hammer it, eat it down where it's short. And of course, while they're doing that, they're urinating, they're defecating. Those cloven hooves are breaking up the soil cap, and then when we move them to the next paddock, we call it, which is every day, that we won't be back to that for about 45 days to give it time to recover. And that's how that soil changed so abruptly. It's like, you know, those, and this is part of the climate change, climate impact side of it. You know, those plants are photosynthesizing, that's the energy cycle. They're breathing in greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, and whatever else, pulling it out of the atmosphere, turning it into fat and protein and carbohydrate. That is the plant tissue. Some of it's above the ground where the cows can eat it or the animals can eat it. Some of it's below the ground in the form of roots. And it's part of nature, part of the design of things for ruminants to come through and harvest off that grass on top so that photosynthesis can begin. And when they do, it starts to slough some of the roots off from the bottom. And that carbon that was in those roots is marooned down there for some period of time. And then they, you know, plants photosynthesize, grow again. So the plant is literally like a pump, pulling greenhouse gases down, putting it in the soil. In addition to that, the plant, when it's growing and photosynthesizing, taking those greenhouse gases and turning it into carbohydrates, sucrose, sugar, is pumping it into the roots. And those roots leak. We didn't know about that 15 years ago. But those roots intentionally leak. And that sucrose feeds microbes in the soil. And those microbes in the soil consume that sugar and exchange it chemically for minerals, You know, those microbes in the soil, there's no energy down there. That comes from the sun. But there's minerals. Those plants need minerals. They got energy because they can create or they can transform it from radiation to chemical. So it's just a beautiful symbiotic system that's working. And that's why, to those of us who understand it, when we hear the junk science of cattle are destroying the climate, it is just so junk science. Now, cattle that aren't raised in that environment where that symbiosis is going on, yeah, they're contributing to climate change. We're in full agreement. But not cattle that are raised in accordance with the way the natural system is supposed to work. And we can talk about all those systems all day long. It's fascinating to me.
But what you're describing is part of the carbon cycle, which I think is really important for people to understand. The idea that carbon dioxide exists as a gas in the atmosphere. Plants breathe that carbon dioxide in, and that's usually the grass or the trees. They fix that carbon dioxide into carbohydrates, which can either go into the roots of the plants, or they'll make it into sucrose for the bacteria, or it ends up in the plants, which are then eaten by the cows. So that carbon atom in the carbon dioxide goes into the ruminant's gut, and some of that carbon comes back out as a cow burp, methane, which is CH4 as opposed to carbon dioxide, which is CH2, and that goes back into the atmosphere and eventually becomes carbon dioxide again, and that is the carbon cycle. But if we could follow one single individual carbon atom as a part of carbon dioxide and then becoming a part of a carbohydrate and then becoming a part of a sucrose molecule in the roots or a part of the methane from a cow, that single carbon atom is just cycling. The carbon is not created or destroyed. There's no nuclear reactions here. There's no fission or fusion changing or creating carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide becomes methane, and then that methane becomes carbon dioxide. So cows are not creating or destroying carbon. And I think this is what people don't understand when they're saying that cows are contributing to climate change, especially not the cows that are raised like you do at White Oak Pastures. They're cycling this carbon, and as a part of that process, they're doing a couple of amazing things. Number one, they're turning grass, which humans cannot eat, into delicious, nutritious animal meat and organs. And number two, they're a part of changing that light brown colored weak soil, which is only 1% organic matter, to the coffee grounds 5% organic matter soil that prevents runoff and erosion that you're talking about. So cows are like this miraculous axle around which this incredible cycle happens. And I think people also don't understand this cycle has been happening for millions and millions of years. Previous to cows, it was their relatives, aurochs, whatever we want to call them, and bison on the grasslands doing exactly that. And that's basically what you're trying to mimic at White Oak Pastures, isn't it? Just grassland animals grazing and doing their thing. I mean, I've heard people say this, correct me if I'm wrong. Is that why the American West was such a fertile ground? Like the soil in the American West was so fertile on those grasslands because bison and other ruminant animals like cows or deer or elk or pronghorn were eating the grass and doing this magical work of enriching the soil for millions and millions of years.
That's exactly right. Well said. And they're creating the abundance. And it's not just American West, the Serengeti Plain in Africa, to a lesser extent, smaller extent, this savanna that was here in the Gulf Coast. That's the abundance that we talk about. And all those things that you said were very, very, very well put. And there's scientific evidence that's been proven right here on White Oak Pastures that it's working the way we say it works. If you look at our website, whiteoakpastures.com, under the environmental stewardships tab, there's a scientific study done called LCA, Life Cycle Assessment, that shows that our grass-fed beef that we sell, we actually sequester 3.5 pounds of carbon dioxide equivalent every pound of grass-fed beef we sell. So all these things that Paul described has been proven scientifically by a third-party environmental engineering group that did not have a dog in my fight. They were here to see.
And I appreciate that in that analysis, in the life cycle analysis, they contrasted that with like plant-based burgers, right? And, which are not carbon negative, right? But like, you know, if you raise cattle the way that bison and other ruminants have always moved on the land, you get this sequestration of carbon into the soil. But, you know, plant-based burgers don't do that.
Well, I wasn't even getting into it, but I'm glad you did. That falls under the category of too good to be true. Just coincidentally, the same environmental engineering group called Qantas International Group, headquartered in this country in Minneapolis, Minnesota, did a LCA life cycle assessment on Impossible Burger. And too good to be true, but they found that Impossible Burger emits 3.5 pounds, the exact same number of carbon dioxide equivalent for every pound of Impossible Burger they sell. So if you want to have a neutral carbon footprint, for every pound of Impossible Burger that you eat, you got to eat a pound of mine so you can break even. That's incredible. That's just too good to be true, but it's true.
And there's been some
It showed that we sequester, depends on how you do the math, but 1, 2, 3 tons of carbon per acre per year that used to be up there. Keep in mind, we didn't add any carbon to the soil. All that carbon was, and as you said, matter is neither created nor destroyed. It just moves around. So all that carbon that we have put into our soil used to be greenhouse gas that through the magic of photosynthesis and ruminant activity was put back down. I think it's somewhat intentional how the technocrats are villainizing carbon. You know, carbon is an element on the periodic chart. And there's the same amount of carbon on this planet today that there was when the dinosaurs roamed there. It's just where how we have managed the system has moved it around to a place, and it's harmful now.
Yeah, that's a whole separate podcast about how carbon has been demonized, but it is really interesting, and I think that there's so much ecological parallel and elegance in what you're doing at that farm and what all regenerative farms are doing when you farm cattle right. I mean, the proof is in the quote pudding. Like, this is that's why I wanted to start the podcast with those two jars of soil and the video of the runoff. This isn't hand waving. You can see it in the soil. You can see the organic matter. You can see how I hesitate to even call it a machine, but this breathing ecosystem that you've created or helped to flourish, perhaps is more accurate verbiage, at White Oak, is a machine, an organic machine that regenerates soil. You told me once you're a soil farmer.
Grass farmer.
Yeah. You just happen to have cattle.
I am that, but I'm also a cynical old man. And I don't ask anybody to take my word for anything. Of the things I tell you, you come here and I'll show you. I can show it to you. And we do. The doors are open with full transparency. You can see anything you want to see. And we invite people. You know, the greatest nemesis that people like us have is greenwashed material. And you know what I mean by that.
But explain it to the audience.
Okay, so in our vernacular, greenwash product is product that's industrially produced or pretty industrially produced, but the wordsmiths talk about it differently to confuse the consumer. So they think it's the same thing that we're doing. Now, I say we. I'm not just talking about White Oak Pasture. I'm talking about regenerative farms all across the country. This is not a self-serving personal White Oak Pasture. There are others. There are a number of others. But the vulnerability we have and the thing that has kept this movement down is greenwashed product that devalues what we do. And the sword and shield that we have against greenwashed product is transparency and sincerity. You can come look. You don't take my word for it. Don't take their word for it, and don't take my word for it. Come and see.
And I think that people will be able to see, you know, the soil and the cows and the ecosystems. And one of the coolest things that you've told me while I was there was about, I think if people came to the farm, they would see this, the way that you combine the species, this sort of symbiosis that you've talked about. There's a really interesting example that you've described to me about these different parasites that the organisms have. And when you combine cows with, I don't know if it was sheep or goats, it interrupts these life cycle. Talk about that a little bit, because I found this so fascinating, and it recapitulates what you're talking about with the symbiosis. The idea that raising one species, whether it's kale, lettuce, corn, soybeans, or cattle on the land doesn't make a lot of sense. But if you put multiple species in there together, in this case, cows and sheep or goats, it just works well. And that's just so elegant to me that how this all plays out.
Yeah, well, you got a great recollection. So you know, we start out with the premise that nature abhors a monoculture. There's nowhere in nature that one species of plant or animal or microbe exists at the expense of everything else. That just does not happen. It takes a lot of technology to make that happen, which is what we do in factory farming. So, and when you do use technology to raise a monoculture, it opens the door for you to cure symptoms. If you have a fungus, you use a fungicide. If you have an insect, you use an insecticide. If you have a plant pest, you use a herbicide. Side, by the way, means kill, so you know. In a more natural ecosystem, you've got a lot of different plants and animals and microbes living in symbiotic relationships with each other. What is food for one, an enemy for one's food for the other. And the example Paul was talking about is something that I couldn't even find research to support it, but I've emulated it a number of times, so I know it's true. One year I had pigs in the woods, which pigs are forest creatures, and we try to keep them there. And I weaned my kids, baby goats or kids, like lamb or baby sheep. I weaned them, and I put some of them in another forest paddock that I had, the males. And the females I put in with the pigs. And after a few weeks, I noticed that the kids that were in with the pigs looked better than the ones that were alone in a monoculture, basically a monoculture. And I didn't know why that was. And then upon closer scrutiny, I saw that the hogs looked extraordinarily good. And I certainly couldn't understand why that would be. But I hypothesized and couldn't find evidence to support it, but I couldn't find evidence to not support it either. Here's what was happening. So goats eat plant material that hogs won't eat. You've heard heard it said that goats will eat anything. Well, no, goats won't eat anything. They have a broad tolerance for plant material that they can eat, digest, assimilate. And it goes through the goat, through that fermentation chamber. It comes out as goat manure. And this may not sound pleasant to you, but pigs eat manure. They eat goat manure. So when those pigs were eating that goat manure, and I watched them do it, they were taking in fermented plant material that they could not have gotten without those goats being in there. It's just brilliant, except it was an accident. So that explained why the hogs looked better, but it didn't explain why the goats looked better. So we checked the feces for the presence of barber pole worm. That's an internal parasite, a nematode, that sucks blood from the lining of the animal's intestine. And the goats that were in with the pigs had way less barber pole worms than the ones who were in a monoculture. Well, why would that be? And the answer is the life cycle of a barber pole worm is this is not very pleasant, but the mature worm is stuck shooting with by its mouth to the wall of the intestine. It sucks blood all day long, and it spews sperm and eggs that get fertilized in the intestine. When the animal defecates, that worm egg, fertilized worm egg, is in the feces. It hatches. And the little neonate, baby worm, climbs up a stalk of grass, and the animal reinfects itself or its neighbor by eating that grass. Well, when that hog ate that goat manure, that fertilized egg, it was never going to become a neonate. So that's such a complex system that science just doesn't lend its science, which is so siloed, doesn't lend itself to understanding that. And it's hard to teach. It's hard to implement. You can't write a how-to manual. Nobody makes money on it. No big multinational corporation from Silicon Valley or Wall Street makes. So there's a lot of reasons why that sort of experiential wisdom goes away and is replaced by technology.
And so this is so interesting to me. It's like there's an Instagram account, Nature is Metal. If people find this story gross, this is the way life works in nature. Animals have parasites, even in the best conditions. But it's fascinating to me that when animals are not in monoculture, when they're not by themselves, they sort of in some ways work together. There's some elegance here that's bigger than us. They're interrupting parasitic life cycles of another species that allows both species to kind of thrive together. And that's really cool. And that's something that isn't often recreated in natural farming. Now, I don't think people need to worry about these parasites if they're eating these animals because they don't infect the muscles and it's not a health risk there. It's a risk for the animals to be not as healthy, not getting as many nutrients. But it's so cool that you saw the baby goats or the baby sheep healthier and the pigs healthier. And it just recreates, it just reminds us that these animals are meant to coexist. This is the way it's always happened. That's essentially what you're trying to do on this farm is put species together, enable symbiosis so that all the animals are as healthy as possible. And we know that while they're doing that, they're eating the foods they're supposed to be eating. They're eating grass their whole life. And that's making the soil healthier. So the improvements in the ecosystem are at so many levels. There's a soil improvement in the ecosystem. The grass is healthier. The animals are healthier. The animals that the animals are with are healthier. And then the atmosphere is changed in a less carbon dioxide rich way, which many people believe is a positive thing. So that's really fascinating.
What you said about the parasites, one of the ancient Greeks said that for every pestilence that nature sends, she sends the cure. And I believe that. I believe that every naturally occurring species in an ecosystem has a function there, including those parasites. And I don't know exactly what they do. I don't know what good gnats do. I really don't, I can't have mosquitoes. Yeah, but I'm convinced if it's a naturally occurring, naturally evolved species from that ecosystem, it has a role. And what we do when we use pesticides is we endeavor to wipe out that species. And the species is, in the pestilent species, in my mind, is a symptom. It's not a problem. The question shouldn't be, how do I kill all these army worms? The question should be, what happened in this system to cause these army worms to be out of balance? When you take the first extinction effort to solve the problem and eliminate the symptom, there are highly efficacious pesticides out there that wipe out the army worms, but they also wipe out the beneficial insects that prey on the armyworms. So if the armyworms come back, you're solely at that. And I can just go on and on with that. If treating symptoms without addressing the root problem is always problematic. But people make a lot of money selling the technologies to do that.
Yeah, Yeah, I think that is one of the most true statements I've ever heard. And I see that in medicine as well, the way we use pharmaceuticals to treat a symptom and not get to the root cause. But here it is, clear as day in agriculture, something that I know, you know, very little about, but it's paralleled across many facets of human existence. I want to go back to greenwashing for a moment because I feel like I glossed over that. I just want people to understand. I want to tell a quick story about Whole Foods. I don't think I'll get sued, but I might. Hopefully not. So when I go to Whole Foods, I've done some reels about this. This is what I see as greenwashing, and you tell me if this is true. They label their beef pasture raised, and they have a separate beef that is grass fed and grass finished, but they have pasture raised and grass fed. And to me, that sounds like the same thing. I mean, what's the difference if you're raising it on a pasture or feeding it grass? But this to me is a good example of greenwashing, that they're almost being, I think, disingenuous with consumers a little bit, right? And saying, this is pasture raised. But then when I ask them, hey, is this fed grass its whole life? They say, no, it's fed grains at the end. So basically, this is probably better than a very factory farm beef. It's on pasture, but then they'll openly tell you when you ask them. So they're not being completely duplicitous. This meat that says pasture raised at Whole Foods is fed grains at the end of its life, like all grain finished cattle is. Most grain finished cattle is on pasture, and then it goes to a feedlot for the last part of its life where it gets fattened up. So it's not really different than a grain fed, you know, cow anywhere, but they're selling it as pasture raised, which is confusing the consumer. And it, like you said, I think that devalues what you are doing at White Oak, which is true regenerative rotational grazing, grass feeding, grass finishing. You're not using grass pellets. I've heard some farms will say grass fed and they'll use grass pellets or grass seeds. There's all sorts of ways to game the system that are really not honest and accurate. And that's what we say when we mean greenwashing. And that's why I think it's important to emphasize that to people, that like, know your farmer and understand what they mean when they say grass fed, and there's different levels of quality there. Did I do that justice?
Yeah, I think you did a good job. We could talk about it all day, but the sad truth is the USDA labeling system is intentionally fraudulent. You can literally, a big multinational meat company can, and they do, buy beef from Uruguay or New Zealand or Australia or any number of other places, animals that were born, raised, and slaughtered halfway around the world, loaded on a container, brought here, and labeled product of the USA. If any other value was added to it, they ground it up in the ground beef or cut it up into steaks. That's so fraudulent. And we can go on and on with that. To the fact, just you cannot rely, consumers cannot rely on the USDA label. Don't do that. You certainly can't rely on what the wordsmiths say about it and put on the label, that the greenwashing we talked about. You would think that everything that you eat in the grocery store is raised in this pristine, wonderfully managed environment, and that's simply not the case. People, consumers, don't have the bandwidth to get to know their farmer. I know they don't, but they're going to have to if they want to know what they're eating. If you don't care, it doesn't matter. But if you do, you need to know something about your farmer. And, in the best case, you go and spend the night on the farm. We built cabins so people come spend the night on this farm and take tours and go and look. You can take a guided tour. You can just get out there and look on your own. It doesn't matter. Shut the gate if you can go on it. And that would be perfect. But if you can't do that, know that you're buying from a farm that you could if you wanted to, and people are doing it. We get there's probably two or three or more dozen people on this farm right now, eating, sleeping, walking around, and you could too. And through the magic of social media, you can look and see what's happening and see those people doing your inspection for you. The whole verification inspection thing did not go the way I had hoped. I've been in this long enough that when certifications became vogue, I thought, man, this is going to be great. And we just get certified. But there are so many certifications, and some of them are such low-hanging fruit that you can't depend on that any more than you can the what USDA says or what the label says. You got to take it on yourself, and it's sad, but it's true.
Yeah, I remember staying at White Oak in the cabin that's on the lake, and you told me stories about wrestling alligators in that lake or so. Didn't you tell me you used to jump in that lake after alligators, Will?
I did not say wrestle. So I live, that cabin, that pond house, we call it, is pretty nice now. We fixed it up, spent some money on it. But when I lived in it as a young man, and it was really, really rustic. And I did most of my shaving and bathing in the pond. And there's a lot of alligators in the pond. And I did not endeavor to wrestle with them, and I never did. I never touched one. But when I would put my 200-pound body in that water, they'd come off the bank. And it was it's amazing how quick you can shave and bathe.
I just imagined you wrestling with them. That was my fault.
No, I didn't wrestle. No. Let's keep it. Factual.
Keep it factual. But those alligators have never harmed anybody at White Oak Pastures. It's just a cool place, and it's just a cool house because you can see like the natural wildlife there is what I want to say.
That's part of the ecosystem.
Ecosystem. Yeah. So I think that if people are listening to this, hopefully we've done a decent job of helping them understand the difference of what you're doing at White Oak Pastures with regenerative agriculture. We talked about the soil and the sequestration of carbon and the carbon cycle and basically the runoff and how it makes better animals, healthier animals, which are more nutritious and feed humans. And I think the question that always comes up, and I know Joe Rogan asked you this on the podcast, I just want to make sure we answer this for people or at least get you to weigh in, is scalability. And I think this is a little bit of a straw man argument against regenerative agriculture. It's certainly an argument that's used against the work that I do when I say that people should eat more meat. I say, well, everybody on the planet can't eat this much meat. And so I just want to get your take on this scalability argument, because I think that when I'm talking to people who are not a fan of animal agriculture, I can at least get them to admit that what you're doing at White Oak Pastures and regenerative agriculture in general is way better than factory farming. And if they really look at the science, it's hard to argue with it. But then the only real comeback they've got is, but you could never scale it. So I'm sure you've heard this. What is your response to that? That we couldn't possibly make every farm in the world regenerative. It's kind of a tough one to address, but let's tackle it head on.
Yeah, I mean, I think I can answer that. So here, White Oak Pastures, we've got 180 something employees. We sell about $26 million worth of product a year. We own about 5,000 acres of land. And we've scaled up about as big as we need to be. Now, I really don't. Growing White Oak Pastures is not part of our business plan, but it's highly replicatable. There will never be a White Oak Pastures that's as big as Tyson or Smithfield or Cargill. It's not meant to be. It's not linear scalable, but it is replicatable. There could be a White Oak Pastures or two or three in every ag county in the country, and there should be. We'd have a lot more resilient food supply. Be a lot better for the animals, a lot better for the land, the climate. Certainly for rural America, certainly for the re-enrichment of our rural countryside. Now, so that's the answer there. Yes, you can feed the country like that, or feed the world like that. Now, the other story side of the coin is that we hear is, we'll run out of land and the population, a percentage of it, will be starving. Well, The earth has a limited carrying capacity. We cannot continue to increase the population of the earth in perpetuity forever. It'll be okay. Something will run out and break the system down. Now, if it's petroleum is the short stave in the barrel, I can feed more people than the industrial model. If it's phosphate and potassium and other minerals are mined productively from the soil, my system will feed more people. If it's antibiotics that the pathogens are not resistant to, I can feed more people. If it's water, I can feed more. On and on, many, many different facets of production, my system will feed more people per acre. But if it's acreage, then you know, we won't win.
And I think that, yeah, I'll add my perspective on it too, just to kind of complete the idea here. But there's, so if we think about this, whenever I get asked this question, I think back to a few conversations I've had. One of them with Diana Rogers, who you know well, with Rob Wolf and their book Sacred Cow. Mm-hmm. And Diana said something on a podcast that I thought was really insightful, which is, you don't really want to feed everyone in the world garbage. She said that there's basically enough calories for everyone in the world right now, but there's not enough nutrients for everyone in the world. And there's not a huge benefit to feeding everyone in the world on nutrient-poor grains. What's the point of feeding everyone nutrient-poor foods? I don't think that's a solution either, because then you end up with millions and millions, hundreds of millions of malnourished humans. The goal, we need to make sure that we all have the same goal. I think the goal should be to nourish all the humans on the planet. Now, as you're saying, we get into some sticky territory here because we have approaching 8 billion people on the planet. But I think that the North Star, the goal should be, how do we nourish as many people as deeply as possible? Because we know that if we don't get micronutrients into people, people are not as healthy, they're not as happy, they're not as productive, and they're not as creative and problem solving. I mean, I've talked about this on my social media. When we give creatine, a nutrient found exclusively in animal foods like meat, to vegetarians, they do better on card sorting and memory tasks. So we are essentially allowing humans to manifest a higher potential by feeding them animal foods. We make vegetarians smarter by feeding them steaks. And that's just one nutrient. We're not talking about choline, carnitine, anserine, taurine, B12, K2, biotin, riboflavin. So I see it differently. I think that this is a straw man argument because the goals are wrong. You know, it's not just to get calories into humans. The goal is to nourish humans and to make them as healthy as possible. And when we do that, we think, oh, then animal foods are almost certainly part of the equation, whether that's milk or eggs or meat, hopefully all of them, definitely organs. Like, that's how we make healthy and vital humans. And so animal foods have to be part of that conversation. And then we can get into conversations about land use and the Conservation Reserve Program, which is a government-funded program that pays farmers to not farm their land because the land has been so stripped of resources because of monocrop agriculture. And this is where I think you and White Oak Pastures teaching people how to do regenerative agriculture and the replication of what you're doing comes in, because what you know and what you are telling people, which I believe is very true, is that the best way to take non-fertile land, like that soil we saw in the beginning of the podcast that has a low amount of carbon in it, and to make it into rich soil is by putting animals on the land. So people should understand that there are, I believe, hundreds of millions of acres in the United States alone, check me on that scale, that are in the Conservation Reserve Program that are not actually being farmed because they've been monocrop plant agricultured. I'm using that as a verb, into oblivion. So how do we get those back? We put animals on them in the proper way, And then we start to see the equation kind of change. And then we say, okay, that makes more sense. Is that all landing okay?
You know, Paul, I'm certainly the furthest thing from a sociologist. You know, I don't know about these things, but I do know I rail against confinement animal feeding operations. Mm-hmm. Now, confinement animal feeding operation is where you put the maximum density of animals you possibly can in a confined place and feed them the cheapest food that they can survive on. Is that what we want to do with the planet? Do we want to turn it into a CAFO for people where we put as many people as we can possibly keep alive here and feed them whatever it is we can produce that'll keep them alive? Is that the goal?
That's not what we want to do.
it didn't seem quite right to me.
No. And I think that we as humans have some pretty deep, important questions to ask ourselves. What do we want our futures to look like? I mean, you know, what do we want our children's future to look like? How do we want them to live? Do we want them to be in, like you're saying, CAFO, clustered animal feed, you know, in these high density places and nobody having space and everybody eating Soylent Green slop? I don't think that's what we want for humans in the future. So there's different realities there, but I think that the question of scalability brings up some pretty deeply rooted questions for all of us here. So, well, what do you see as the path forward? I mean, you guys are doing what you do at White Oak. Is it just teaching more people about how to do this? Like you said, replicating this, having lots or more of these regenerative farms, changing the public consciousness. How do we do this?
Well, we do teach people how. We formed a nonprofit last year called the Center for Agricultural Resilience, CFAR, C-F-A-R, Center for Agricultural Resilience. And we teach people, farmers how to farm, but also environmental attorneys, land planners, city planners, ecologists, all kind of people come here, and we have sessions and we teach it. So that's one answer to the question. The other answer is, kind of an identity crisis that we have, White Oak Pastures has. I don't know if I'm a niche producer or if I'm an early innovator in how we're going to produce food in this country. You know, I don't know. Early on, I wanted to be an innovator changing the way we produce food. And along the way, I kind of became pretty pragmatic and said, that's not going to happen. But I'll be a niche producer, and I've got my ecosystem here and my people here that I provide for, and that's okay, and it is okay. But regenerative land management, regenerative food production has kind of caught traction in the last, I'm amazed, I've been in it 25 or more years. The last year or two has caught traction more than it did in the first 20-something combined. So maybe we are early in how to produce food, food produced differently. I hope so. I'll say this. If the food system changes, if the food system changes, it's not going to be because government wanted to change. Farm program won't do that. It damn sure won't be because big ag or big food won't change. It won't be because the land grant universities start to think differently. I can go on and on about why it won't be. If it happens, it's going to be because of consumer demand, period. Consumers got to drive that train if it happens.
And I think that's why I think this is so amazing to be able to have you on and talk to people about this and get it out to people on the podcast and talk about it on social media, because that's what we're both doing, is trying to, have you ever heard the term red pill, Will? Do you know what red pilling someone means?
No, I don't get out much.
I mean, have you seen the movie The Matrix?
I heard of it. No, I didn't see it.
Maybe the next time I'm in Bluffton, you and I can watch The Matrix, Will.
Let's do something else.
You don't want to do a Matrix movie night? All right, maybe we'll go do something else.
If John Wayne ain't in it, I don't really want to watch it.
All right, fair. Well, there's a movie called The Matrix, and there's a scene in The Matrix where a character named Morpheus gives Neo, who's another character, two pills to choose from. One of them's a red pill, one of them's a blue pill. And he says, you take the red pill. I forget the exact quote. You realize the reality of what's going on around you. You take the blue pill, you go back to sleep, and you lead a happy life. So red pilling people is a colloquialism that means helping people wake up from the mass hypnosis that we've got today. So you may not know it, but you're a part of a red pill movement, my friend. So be proud of that.
Now that I know that, I was raised on red pills.
I think that's probably a big reason that you do the work that you do, and that you were able to think outside of the box and go left, you know, when all of your colleagues kept going straight with their mainstream agriculture farms. But I think helping people wake up and helping people understand that there's different value systems in play here, and that can change the quality of their life, is what it's all about. But I agree with you completely. I don't think the change is going to come from the top down. I think it's going to be a consumer tsunami that will overwhelm the food system, and people will demand this type of food, and they will want higher quality food. And I think it starts here. So,
you know, and sadly, you're talking about big change. And sadly, almost nothing brings about change other than pain. That's just the way that works.
It's true.
I'm gonna plug something here, Paul. About a year and a half ago, we sold the book rights to White Oak Pastures to Random House Viking Penguin. And they wrote the book, and it's out. It'll be out in September.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's called A Bold Return to Giving a Damn. And, I'm going to send you a copy when it comes out.
That sounds amazing. So that'll be out in September.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll do another podcast before it comes out and let people know. But it's a cool story. I think that there's a lot there. And I was really proud to see you on Joe Rogan, man. Were you nervous? I was nervous when I was. You seem cool as a cucumber.
You know, there's a reason. I've known a lot of successful people in my life. And when somebody's at the top of their game, there's a reason for it. And he's certainly at the top of his game. And it's because he's good at it. You and I have a personal relationship. In the same way I didn't know what the red pill was, I didn't know who Joe Rogan was. I don't get out much. But when he contacted us, Jenny, my daughter, to be on the show, it was like you. He did it himself. You know, I've been on some other podcasts with some clerk type of third class, sets right. It up, and Joe Rogan emailed Jenny and started the dialogue. So I now know who he is, and I know a lot of people don't like him. I'm going to tell you now, he is good at what he does. By the time I met him like 45 minutes before the interview, and by the time we got by that interview, I felt like I'd known him all my life. You know, I'd have told him whatever he wanted to know, and there's a reason for that.
He's a good human. He's a good human. When I did my podcast with him, I was so nervous the first time, and we ended up hanging out for maybe 20 or 30 minutes before, thankfully, because I was able to calm my nerves a little bit. I still think I was pretty nervous on the podcast, but he's a really good human. I appreciate him a lot, and I was really proud and glad to see you on there, and I know it's getting the message out, and I appreciate you coming on here today, spending some time with me, and I hope people will find this valuable. People can find you guys at whiteoakpastures.com and the Instagram. Then you got the book coming out in September. Anything else people can check you guys out? I think they should come visit you at White Oak and do the tour. Get Will Harris as your private tour guide.
There's a great lady named Ruth Reichel, who was she's a best-selling writer. She's a way on out in her career. She had a documentary made in White Oak. It's called Food and Country. White Oak Pastures is included. It's not about us, but we're one of the farms that's included in it. And it was invited to be at the Sundance Film Festival last week. So we're optimistic about that, helping get the word out.
Again, what's the name of her movie?
Food and Country.
Food and Country?
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, if people don't know, the cookbook that I made with Sarah and Ashley Armstrong, the Carnivore Code cookbook, is we did a lot of all the pictures are from White Oak Pastures, and all the food in that book was prepared in the kitchen at White Oak Pastures and photographed at White Oak Pastures. So if people want to get a little more of a pictorial tour of White Oak, they can check out the cookbook. But I think everyone should just go. They should stay in the pond house and say hi to the friendly alligators there. Or maybe, stay wherever you want at White Oak, but get some tours with Will around the farm and see the cows and see the pigs and everything. So thank you for coming on, my friend, and I hope I see you in person soon.
Thank you for having me. It's always good to see you. You're always welcome here.